scientific discoveries to such a degree, I forget which I've reported in what context. So, but I got a couple of discoveries here, one of which I may have already reported on that actually hooked together and actually reflect on what we're studying here in the Book of Job. And I am glad we got lots of time, not because I'll have lots of time, but you're going to have lots of time. We've got some special assignments for you, which should be fun. But did I report to you about the discovery out of Australia of the bass? No, I guess not. I did. Yeah, Australia was discovered. This discovery was out of Australia. Of vast petroleum deposits that date. No, it didn't. Okay, let me do this in introduction. And then we got one on fungus. It's really exciting. Okay? All right. None of us would be here if it wasn't for fungus. So I'll explain that to you in a minute. So, you know, as we've been looking at the Book of Job, how we need to be thanking God for some of these strange creatures that He created. Hopefully today you'll walk away with some reasons to thank God for fungus. So, but first of all, let's look at the petroleum. A group of Australians have been studying what's called the Pilbara deposit in Australia. And this is a very ancient rock formation in Western Australia. It's a huge desert out there. And they have found two particular Pilbara deposits that date to 3.25 billion years ago and 2.63 billion years ago. And it's been noted for some time that there are these carbonaceous materials there that get transformed in petroleum. But the speculation has been that this was transformed through non-organic means rather than organic material. And so this Australian petroleum engineer went into this region and dug around to the degree where he found that there was vast quantities of this petroleum. So previously they were finding small bits of it, and they weren't too sure what kind of petroleum products they were looking at. In this case, this got published in the latest issue of Geology. Birger Rasmussen is the geophysicist that did this research. And what he was able to determine is that the carbonaceous residues were composed of abundant kerogen streaks and laminae, bitumen nodules, globules, films, aggregates, and what was particularly interesting is he found what he called a bunch of pyrobitumen. You say, what's pyrobitumen? It's the byproduct of the degradation of petroleum. And he found it as globules, films, and large masses of this pyrobitumen. Now you say, what's the significance of all this? Well, two things. The variety in which he found these kerogen tars is such that it could only be generated by biological means. And likewise, the quantity can only be explained by a biological pathway. If you're talking a non-organic pathway, like they're speculating maybe Mars has got some petroleum on it that they could speculate, well, we know that on Mars it wouldn't be generated by life. It would be generated by non-organic means. Therefore, there's only tiny quantities of it at best, and you're only going to find it in one form. And what we're discovering here is they found it in 8 different forms and in huge quantities. Therefore, it can't be non-organic. It must be organic. Now, what I thought was particularly exciting, so this has kind of settled the controversy, is this ancient petroleum organic or non-organic? We now know it's the result of biological material that's died and decayed. But what excited this particular geophysicist is that the quantity and the diversity was such that he was able to identify what kinds of life forms decayed to make this petroleum. And he said it's photosynthetic organisms and chemosynthetic organisms. Now, the significance about this is these are rather advanced bacterial life forms. Life forms that have anywhere from 1,800 to 4,000 gene products. And we're talking about material that dates earlier than 3.25 billion years. And the sheer quantity of the kerogens he discovered establishes that life must have been extremely abundant on the face of the Earth much before 3.25 billion years ago. In order to get that amount of kerogen to be piled up by 3.25 billion years ago, there must have been abundant life that considerably predated that 3.25 billion years ago. And this confirms a significant prediction we made in our Origins of Life book. In fact, you'll see the prediction in the book if you go over there and look at it. Namely, that the first life on planet Earth was complex and diverse and abundant. And this discovery confirms all three. And if the first life is abundant and diverse and complex, then it can't be through a natural origin process. We're looking at supernatural intervention to explain the origin of life. And then another point I'd like to add, the fact that we see life provably so abundant and diverse previous to 3.25 billion years ago fits the context of a creator creating life very early, aggressively, in order to pack the earth with the necessary biodeposits to sustain human civilization at a high-tech level. I mean, we kind of walk around this planet taking for granted that we have these vast storehouses in the crust of the earth of limestone and marble and gypsum and petroleum and coal, oil, natural gas. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Think of all the metals that we mine, the copper, the zinc, the gold, the molybdenum, iron. All that's concentrated by vast mats of bacteria that existed many billions of years ago. So Adam and Eve would have never gotten out of the Stone Age if it wasn't for billions of years of huge quantities of diverse bacterial colonies inhabiting the Earth. If it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have any of these metals to mine, and we certainly wouldn't have the limestone, the marble, and the petroleum, etc. Yes. If we run out of petroleum, are we going to run out of natural gas? Natural gas is a byproduct of petroleum. So you start off with the petroleum, and bacteria, there's certain bacteria that eat petroleum. And when they eat petroleum, they degrade it into natural gas. And so when you find a natural gas deposit, that's always a sign that maybe there's still some oil left around. So people look for natural gas as maybe the bacteria haven't done their job yet. But in that sense, as long as you've got bacteria eating petroleum, you will get natural gas production. But if you pump all the petroleum out of the ground, the bacteria won't have anything to eat, and you won't get that natural gas. However, some methane is produced by non-organic means. I mean, for example, they found methane whipping out of three different spots on Mars. And the understanding is that that's not a sign of biological activity. Rather, that's a sign of non-organic mechanisms working in the interior of the Earth. Methane's rather simple. It's just one carbon atom and four hydrogen atoms. So there are some ways to make methane. In fact, we see methane in interstellar clouds. So there are ways to make that, but you won't make a lot of it. So when we exhaust all the petroleum and burn off all the natural gas, we're not going to have a lot of production after that. Unless, of course, we start exploiting corn as a way to make these fuels. But that will be limited. So, given all the tar sands and the shales that we have in Colorado and Alberta, we're probably good for another 400 years. However, when 400 years are up, we're in trouble. And we're really in trouble because when we stop burning all these fossil fuels, we're going to go quickly into a severe ice age. We're basically have forestalled the ice age. The ice age is 5,000 years overdue. I think I talked about that in this class about 3 months ago, that we're overdue for an ice age, and it's going to hit with a vengeance once we stop burning fossil fuels. Now, that doesn't mean we should burn fossil fuels faster to stave off the ice age. In fact, we're burning them at a faster rate than we need to burn them to stave off the ice age. We could actually stave off the ice age for 1,000 years if we were to burn these fossil fuels at a lower rate. So that in itself might be a reason all by itself to try to buy cars that are more gas efficient. So thank you are first, then over here. Yes. Global warming is good in that it will forestall the ice age. Even if you do everything you can to input global warming, eventually you're not going to be able to push it off. I think it wasn't a couple of weeks ago I talked about a discovery where they found that very tiny variations in the inclinations of Earth's orbit leads to very wild climate swings. Well, about 3,000 years from now, we're going to hit those wild climate swings. And when that happens, no amount of anthropogenic global forcing is going to stave off the disaster of a widespread, long-lasting ice age. You say, how long will it last when it hits? Oh, probably about 85,000 years. And we can have another warming trend after that. So might want to take that into account in your investment portfolios. Okay. Well, you were next. Well, I do know it's a good thing that the sun left its cluster about 4.4 billion years ago, because if it didn't, we wouldn't have life on planet Earth today. Well, probably supernova eruptions. One thing we do know is that planet Earth is the heavy element champion of the universe in terms of planetary bodies. Our planet Earth is loaded with uranium, thorium. It's loaded with lead, all kinds of heavy metals, gold, silver, etc., to a far greater degree than we would expect unless planet Earth happened to have formed right next to three supernova eruptions. And you need three different ones because there are three different kinds of supernova that produce three different kinds of elements heavier than iron. And you need all three in order to get the elements necessary to sustain advanced civilization. So that's one of the amazing design features of planet Earth, is that three different kinds of supernova explosions erupted just as the solar system was forming, and they did not erupt too close. If they did, it would have destroyed the solar system, but they did not erupt too far away, then there wouldn't have been adequate enrichment of these heavy metals. And likewise, the timing has to be just right. If it happens too late after the forming of the solar system, you get no enrichment. And if it happens too early, it doesn't enrich or it blows it apart. So we have this exquisite fine-tuning of these three different supernova eruptions. On the other hand, if you have all three, say, on the same side of the sun relative to the birth cluster in which the sun formed, then those three could form a powerful wind that would blast the sun out of the star cluster at a high velocity and put it into the just right location where advanced life would be possible. Now, you don't want a star having a bunch of neighboring stars around it, and that would have been the case if the sun had stayed put. Well, it may have blown other stars out, but it probably blew them in a different direction, because we don't see any partner stars with the sun that would have come from its birth location. What we see around the sun are stars that have the normal galactic rotational flow. The sun is kind of the exception. And so if there was any star blown out with it, then went in a different direction. So, and again, it's kind of hard figuring out where all these stars exactly were 4.5 billion years ago. Newtonian mechanics is wonderful, but usually it stops being very accurate once you get past a billion years. In the past. Yeah, the sun and the earth have about the same birth date. The earth was formed only a couple of million years after the sun. Yeah, that we know quite well. Okay. Well, that's a very good question. I mean, there's two ways God can do this. He could set up the universe in such a way that he very carefully fine-tunes the dynamics of the universe shortly after the creation event, and then just lets this Newtonian mechanics produce the just right collisions and the just right encounters at the just right times in future history. Or he could let the billions of years go by and intervene at a future point. I was actually involved in a debate amongst scientists or evangelicals on which of these options would be the preferred interpretation. And kind of where we came down is this. Is that we are created in the image of God, and we humans kind of reflect the same desires to create as God does. God loves to create, we love to create. And something that the Fuzz Rana pointed out to us is that when you look inside the cell, you see machines that are amazingly similar to the machines we design. But if we're created in the image of God, it shouldn't be any big surprise that we're designing machines the way He designed them. He gave us that perspective. And so when you look inside the cell, you do find piston engines. You find rotary engines, just like the kinds of engines we make. The only thing we notice is that the engines inside the cell are a whole lot more efficient than the engines we make. They're a lot better. But the basic design structure is the same. And, you know, we kind of pat ourselves in the back and say, aren't we so smart that we came up with all these designs, but, hey, they're already there in the cell in the first place. In fact, one of the discoveries we're going to be talking about on a Creation Update broadcast this week is how they have found another machine inside the cell that's far better in its efficiency and capacity than the ones that we make, and so good that the people who made the discovery are saying, we need to rob this from the cell and attach it to our nano devices, because this is such an elegant design. It's far better than anything we've been able to do in our nanotechnology. But that happens all the time. And so in that context, how do we approach a problem like that? Well, we try to approach the problem by saying, which one is going to take less work and less design intervention to pull it off? And if you use that approach, then the most efficient way for God to set up the solar system the way he wants would be to intervene at several points beyond the creation event rather than trying to do it all at the creation event. Doing it all at the creation event is far more challenging, much more difficult. So, you know, to do some at the beginning and then intervene at later points would be a more efficient way to design. And when you open up the Bible, it seems like God does choose the most efficient design pathway rather than just simply trying to wow us with how smart he is to do it at the beginning. Right. Right. With one important proviso, I mean, you know, one of the world's leading theistic evolutionists, Howard Van Til, takes the argument that it's far more difficult for God to perform all the miracles at the beginning than it would be for him to intervene at different points thereafter. So he's been publicly very critical of us at Reasons to Believe, saying, you guys are interventionists, and it'd be far more marvelous for God to do it all at the beginning. However, there's a theological difficulty there. If God does it all at the beginning, it's extraordinarily more difficult for us human investigators to detect the fingerprint of God than if he were to do interventions at different points thereafter. And doesn't the scripture say that the heavens reveal the glory of God and reveal his righteousness? And part of the reason why God creates the way he does is so we can discover certain things about him. And, you know, one of the things I've said about the Howard Van Til model, I think he's got a fancy name for it, gifted creation, which means God gifts the whole of creation with one gift at the beginning. He doesn't gift at many points thereafter. That one of the weaknesses of that is it's impossible to look at the record of nature, at least with the limited technology we have today, and discover the miraculous hand of God in the design. It's just too far back in time and too far removed from our capacity to investigate. Remember what I said earlier? If you try to apply Newtonian mechanics on the dynamics of the universe, you can do it with high precision for the past billion years. Not bad for the past 5 billion, but if you try to push it all the way back to 14 billion, you get nothing. We simply haven't got the capacity to trace it back that far with any decent precision, and in that sense, the heavens would not reveal the glory of God. They reveal real hints, but not to the same degree. So if you want to know why I take a different approach than Howard Van Til, that's why. But there also seems to be some signs in looking at this collider, for example, that hits the Earth 4.47 billion years ago. There's extraordinary fine-tuning in that that I would find extremely difficult to trace all the way back to 14.7 billion years ago. That's reasonable. I think it's well supported by Scripture. I mean, you can go through Genesis 1, for example, and it lists 13 creation events that God describes. But each one of it is miraculous. And therefore, and you notice it's stretched over 6 days. I mean, why would the Genesis 1 text talk about a sequence of creation events over 6 days if God did everything at the very beginning? Or if you intervene continuously. So it's got to be something in between. You're right. Good point. Yes. Well, I'll tell you one way you can tackle this. I mean, Another critique of Howard Van Til's fully gifted creation is you look at Genesis 1 and Psalm 104 and Job 38, and it uses a variety of creation verbs. And some of those verbs are very interventionist in their definition. You know, I've actually spoke face-to-face with Howard about this, and he just claims, well, you know, all the verbs say the same thing. Well, I don't think that's exegetically supported. There's a big difference between the use of the verb hayah, let there be, which I think does allow for God doing something very early, and the letting be is letting the outcome happen through his design of things in the beginning. But then you've got verbs like yatsar, basar, and asah, where God makes, where he creates. And these are verbs that all exegetes I'm familiar with, linguists, Hebrew linguists, have pointed out as demands God's direct miraculous intervention in different ways. I would argue that the bara requires God's intervention beyond space-time and the laws of physics, whereas asah does not demand that God intervene beyond the laws of physics, but it does demand that he miraculously intervene to manipulate the matter, the energy, to bring about exactly what he wants, where he wants, and when he wants, which I think is kind of what he did when he sent that Mars-sized planet crashing into the Earth 4.47 billion years ago to give us a little extra dose of uranium and iron and thorium and all the stuff we need to sustain civilization much later in the Earth's history. Yes. I don't think I'm going to get to the fungus, but let's right. Okay, we have an artist over there who points out that, it's quite clear just reading this book of Job is that God enjoys creating. He has fun creating. We're created in the image of God. Do not we have fun when we create? It's something we enjoy. And in fact, one of the arguments you could use for God taking his time to create is that it is something that he's enjoying. I mean, it's something I've talked to artists about is when they're really working on a masterpiece, they take their time. When they're trying to make a quick buck, they just do it quickly and sell it. But something that they've really got their heart in, they'll actually take extra time, more time than they need. Why? Because it's just so much fun doing it. And we're like that, and we're created in the image of God, and we see God reflecting that kind of style of creation. And also, I think there's an element of humor in there. You know, it's hard to look at a platypus and not smile. So in that sense, we recognize that God is a playful creator. And again, I think we've got some playful creators in the room. If you ought to see Cliff's collection of cat sculptures. I mean, you want to look at a playful creator, that's it. But guess where Cliff got that from? He was created in the image of God. So, but I think there's lots of us here who can likewise testify. Yes. Well, we're going to get to that when we study the creation accounts in the book of Psalms. Psalm 104, towards the end, makes the statement that it's the property of life to die. I mean, you know, when God creates, the second law of thermodynamics that Romans 8 talks about, how the entire creation is subject to frustration, subject to this law of decay. And so anything that God creates degrades. Just like anything we create degrades. When you create something beautiful and thermodynamics begins to wear it down. Well, because life is created in this context where there is thermodynamics, it eventually dies off. Any life form, even cockroaches, give them enough time, they will go extinct. But it tells us, well, the problem with the cockroaches is it takes about 250 million years for them to go extinct. Whereas a horse or a whale, a few hundred thousand years in their history. However, what it tells us in Psalm 104 is although it's the property of life to die, God recreates. He replaces a species of life that dies off with different species of life. So that by itself would mandate frequent interventions, not continuous interventions. But, you know, when creatures die off, God would replace them with new creatures. And actually, that's part of our biblical creation model. Why? Because we're living in a solar system that experiences dramatic change over its history. Planet Earth, for example, is rotating about 10 times slower today than when that moon-forming collision event took place, 10 or 12 times slower. And you need different life forms on planet Earth when you've got a 4-hour rotation period than you do when you've got an 8-hour rotation period. There's a very good reason why we look at the history of life on planet Earth. The creatures start off very tiny and get progressively bigger and bigger and bigger. The bigger your body size, the greater your probability of being sheared into little pieces by high wind velocities. When you got a wind velocity of 2,000 miles an hour on the surface of the Earth, you want to be a bacterium living on the surface. And then by the time the rotation rate gets down to where it's only 400 miles an hour in windstorms, well, now you can have little insects. But you can't have human beings until we get to 24 hours a day. And even then you get the odd hurricane or two. Yes. What the collision event did is to rapidly spin up the rotation of the Earth. So planet Earth early in its history probably had a slower rotation rate. We don't know how slow. We can't trace the physics before the collision event. But we do know the collision event probably sped up the rotation rate of planet Earth to about 2 hours a day. And then when the moon formed, the gravity of the moon works as a brake to slow down the rotation rate, but it takes a long time to slow it down to a rate that's appropriate for human life. And by the way, that slowing down is still taking place. And what's ideal for human beings is 24 hours a day. 25 is too much, 23 is too little. And so when you hear about all these hurricanes on the news tonight, I think there's a good one going on right now due to hit Texas in a couple of days. If we had a slightly faster rotation rate, Texas would be getting those much more frequently than they are today with higher wind velocities, much more destruction. You say, well, why doesn't God just put us on here when we got 24 and a half hours? Well, then the problem is that we wouldn't get any hurricanes at all. You say, wouldn't that be nice? No, it isn't. We need hurricanes. Hurricanes are critical for putting particulates into the atmosphere to generate adequate rainfall. Hurricanes also play a critical role in cooling the hot spots or the tropics in the summertime. You'd get more extreme effects if it wasn't for those hurricanes. But isn't it wonderful that God happened to create Adam and Eve at the very best rotation period rate, where we get exactly the best number and quantity and intensity of hurricanes to make life ideal for us? Not too many, not too few, not too intense, but make sure they're intense enough. Along, I'll add one other thing. There is significant evidence now that human activity is generating more hurricanes than God intended us to experience, with greater intensity than he intended us to experience. So if you were to ask me what's the greatest consequence in terms of human well-being for the burning of fossil fuels, it's not global warming, it's the fact that we're generating more severe storms. And it's easy to understand, because when you burn fossil fuels, you get two things: the release of greenhouse gases, which globally warm the planet, and the release of particulates, which locally cool the place where those greenhouse or those fossil fuels were burnt. And when you put something that's artificially colder next to something that's artificially warmer, what happens? You get a lower air pressure. Lower air pressure means more severe storms. So that's one provable consequence, yes. Well, there's extinctions that happen at the hand of God. I mean, if you look at the history of planet Earth, there have been several mass extinction events. And where we can demonstrate that it's the hand of God is that these extinction events occur at that point when the millions of species on planet Earth are no longer appropriate to maintain the planet at a condition to sustain life. And so if God were to leave those life forms on the planet, then the entire planet would become sterile in short order. So he removes those life forms that are no longer appropriate for maintaining these delicate balances and replaces them with new life forms that are. But after a period of time, they become inadequate to sustain the balance. And so God uses another mass extinction event to remove them, and then there's a mass speciation event. That's one of the biggest challenges of the evolutionary theory. Every time you see a mass extinction event in the history of the Earth, within a short period of time, in cases where we can measure it, we know it's less than 10,000 years, we see a mass speciation event, which means millions of species get removed, 10,000 years or less, we get millions of new species that replace them. But the millions of new ones are now adapted to deal with the changes in the physics of the sun and the physics of the Earth in a way that the old species could not. You say, well, how long does that work? Well, typically about every 30 million years you need to clean house. In 30 million years there will be enough change in the physics of the sun and the physics of the Earth that the life will no longer be able to maintain the balance. Therefore, you need to clean house and replace it with new stuff. Well, I mean, you could say that's the image of God too, right? I mean, every few years that go by, what do? You clean house and buy new furniture and, you know, decide to add a new room or whatever. I mean, so, but God uses a schedule that's a little bit longer than ours. So, in the back. And actually, several of the mass extinction events were generated by big asteroid collisions. And, you know, when the asteroid collides with the Earth, it generates a lot of heat, but the most damaging effect for life is it throws up a thick dust cloud all around the Earth, which blocks out the light of the sun, stops photosynthesis for a period of time, and has a devastating impact on all the large body size animals. So, for example, the event that took place 65 million years ago in the Yucatan Peninsula, that wiped out 65% of all the species of life on planet Earth. And that was generated by a rock, probably about 6 miles in diameter. Did that kind of damage. And they say, how often does that happen? About once every 50 million years. Well, yeah, NASA actually is working on that, and their appeal to the U.S. government is this, is that the United States government is already taking steps to protect us from things that have a much lower probability of happening than an asteroid hitting one of the cities of the United States. Therefore, shouldn't we be spending some money to try to prevent that from happening? And now I'm not talking a six-mile diameter thing. It's something even 200 feet across were to hit downtown Los Angeles, it would do serious enough damage that the insurance companies wouldn't be able to recover. So, and those, you say, how often does that happen? You'll get an event like that about every 10,000 years. And it's been about 10,000 years since one has happened, so. So as a first step, well, it's all random. I mean, it could be in the next 5,000 years. It could be, not tomorrow. You get a little more advanced warning than that. It's one of the nice things about asteroids. You usually get some advanced warning that something's going to happen. But the whole point is NASA has not yet cataloged asteroids that small. We know all the big ones. And so we know we're not going to get hit with a big one in the near future. But the things that are down around 100 feet, 200 feet, 300 feet, even 400 feet, they've not been cataloged well. And we know lots of them pass close to planet Earth. And so step one is NASA now has funding to do a massive search to discover and track all these small asteroids that pass close to the Earth. Step two will be, now that we know where they're going, we can figure out if they've got a probability of colliding, and if something has a higher than, say, a 30% chance of colliding, then maybe we could use our fancy shuttle system to try to divert one of those asteroids before it hits us. Yes. Well, what's interesting about mass extinction events is it seems like God has got a rather large toolkit for generating these mass extinctions. I mean, one is asteroids hitting the Earth. Another would be comets hitting the Earth. Another one would be gigantic volcanic eruptions. One that's rather interesting would be gamma ray bursts. A gamma ray burst is fun in that it only blasts one hemisphere. And so if you... Well, supposing you've got North and South America loaded with a bunch of unsuitable animals, but Europe and Asia and Africa are okay, then a blast that wipes out life in North and South America, and then you replace those life forms with the different creatures, is really the tool you want. So now you want a gamma ray burst. The thing about a gamma ray burst is it only lasts about 15 seconds. So it's only going to blast one hemisphere. And moreover than that, it's going to have more damage on part of that hemisphere than the edges of that hemisphere. And my whole point is that depending on what kinds of life forms God wants to remove, he's going to use different mass extinction methods. But one of the things we've done at Reasons to Believe is try to look at all these mass extinction events where we got information. And that's really only like the past, we got good information for the past quarter of a billion years. We got less that goes earlier than that. But what we notice is that the frequency of these mass extinction events is just right. That's about the frequency you would want, given how quickly life on planet Earth loses its capacity to maintain the delicate balances that life requires. You know, once every 30 million years is about right. But you need less of the ones that are global in extent as opposed to those that are local in extent. The local ones would be things like, say, huge volcanic eruptions that would take place in only one continent. There has been eruptions that have been global, like the Siberian ones that took place 251 million years ago. And they will wipe out different life forms compared to other life forms. You know, do you want to knock out the bacteria, or do you just want to knock out the large body-sized creatures? Do you want to knock out the plants, or do you want to knock out the animals? Yeah. Okay. Yes, astronomers gained the capacity to see gamma ray bursts only in the last, 6 years. So it's only the last 6 years we've been seeing them. They're the brightest things that we see in the universe. There's nothing more spectacular than a gamma ray burst. But because they are so spectacular, astronomers can see one 10 billion light years away. Well, if it's 10 billion light years away, it's not going to do us any damage. Nothing close. If it was close, the astronomers would not survive, okay? It's a good thing they're not. Anything in our galaxy would be bad news for your investment portfolio. Yeah, Kathy. Okay, yeah, I forgot that part of your question. What about the fact that we humans today are responsible for a mass extinction event? And we really are. In the sense that we have brought to extinction over half the bird species on planet Earth that were here when God created Adam and Eve, and we've brought to extinction over half the land mammals. And what's bad is that we're bringing to extinction those creatures we need the most. And so, North America at one time had camels and horses on it, indigenous camels, horses, there was a rhinoceros here, elephants. And, the first human settlers ate them all. So, wouldn't it be nice to have those kinds of creatures on the face of the earth today? And think of all these large flightless birds. We're now discovering that large flightless birds are a tremendous resource for humans, but all we got left are the ostriches and the emus. It would have been nice if we had had some of those 15-foot-high birds, but they're gone. But, it's only been the last 10 years that we've discovered what a valuable resource these flightless birds are, and we had no idea. And so people just, ate them out of extinction. So in that sense, I'm not claiming that God's hand is behind this human mass extinction event. He commanded us to take care of all these creatures. So I think it's evidence that, we've been violating his command. We've not been taking care of these creatures. And he warned us to take special care of the birds and mammals. And that's where we've done the greatest damage. But hey, we've been messing up the bacteria as well. And just to give you some idea, the base rate for extinctions, independent of mass extinction events, forget about the giant asteroids and the gamma ray bursts, thermodynamics all by itself will bring to extinction one species of life every year, on the average. One a year goes extinct, just by the laws of physics. But because of human activity, we have one species going extinct per day. So we've driven the extinction rate up by a factor of 300 or 400 times, some argue by 1,000 times above the base rate. And we're actually entering what could be the greatest mass extinction event of all time by human abuse. Yes. A lot of speculation on what wiped out Sodom and Gomorrah. Obviously, there's a lot of heat involved. The text makes that clear, but there's lots of ways you can inject heat. The other thing we notice is that the Amorites, who were living very close by, were kept safe. God told Abraham it would only be Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities of the plain. The Amorites would be untouched. In fact, Lot was able to escape to a nearby city that was not touched. So this is a highly focused, localized heat event. And there's been a lot of speculation as to exactly what it is. Some Christians have even speculated that God used a nuclear device, but I don't think so. If he used a nuclear device, it'd be hard for me to imagine the Amorites coming away so well. And after all, there was Abraham looking down and seeing what was going on. So I don't think it was a nuclear device, but some kind of heat thing. One thing we do know is that area is loaded with biodeposits. Now, my position is that God is not restrained in any way. If he wanted to, he could have done everything in the beginning and had the physics just move the way he wanted to by the way he set things up in the beginning. But he has options. He could also set things up in the beginning and intervene thereafter. And so the two extreme positions are that God did interventions only at the beginning of the universe, at no time thereafter. Another extreme position is that God only intervened thereafter and did very little at the beginning. I think the biblically correct way to look at it is that God did both. There was interventions at the beginning of the universe, and then he was doing things thereafter. Remember when we were studying about the expansion of the universe and how the Bible in about 15 different places talks about the expansion of the universe. But remember we're talking about how it uses the verb for expand, nata, in two different forms. The calperfect, which says that God set up the expansion at the very beginning of the universe and set up the physics to guarantee ongoing continual expansion. But then we see the use of the verb nata in the calparticiple form, which talks about God intervening on a continual basis to ensure that the expansion of the universe is just right at different points in cosmic history. And what are we astronomers discovering? That indeed we're seeing this kind of fine-tuning that's occurring at different points in cosmic history. My answer is partly. I mean, my explanation for why the two verb forms, in fact, we meet both verb forms in Job, and we meet them both in Isaiah and Jeremiah. The reason for the choice of both is to communicate that God is not doing it either or, it's both and. So there's miracles he's performing at the beginning that guarantee ongoing continual expansion, but there are miracles that take place after the beginning to tune that expansion at just the right value at the just right time. As Job says in chapter 9, God alone expands the universe. So the fact that God alone is responsible for it, this is something that God has done in the beginning and continues to do thereafter right on into the future. In fact, I believe there's fine tuning in this expansion of the universe will bring about the end of the universe in the future. And keep in mind, we're not only talking about God intervening to set up the solar system just right, he intervenes to set up the galaxy just right. So we're not just talking about God intervening at 13.7 billion years ago and 4.566 billion years ago. He intervenes at various points between 14 billion and 4.6 billion years ago. He must, in order to get the galaxy set up in just the right fashion, that it's able to support a solar system in which life can exist. To some degree, yes. I mean, it's easier to see with life because we're dealing with something enormously more complex and it's close at hand. We don't have to use light from billions of light years and try to sift out what's going on. So it's an easier job for the paleontologist to pick out those interventions. easier for the astronomer, too, because we can see the mass extinction events that are responsible for these different occurrences. But I would argue that it also happens at the purely physical level in setting up the galaxy to be just right and setting up the Earth to be just right. I mean, one obvious example of that is that we have planet Earth, the solar system, forming when the universe is almost exactly two-thirds of its present age. Well, I mean, he can. I mean, I would agree with Howard Van Til that God could do all that, but if he does it the way that Howard Van Til does, then we human observers are not able to discover the hand of his glory in creation. Why? Because we now have put the miracles so distantly into the past that we lack the tools to discern what he did. We lack any way to determine the difference. But that's one of my main critiques of this fully gifted creation hypothesis, is that it's indistinguishable from an atheistic model. I would agree with that, but I mean, you have a very much more limited revelation of God's glory and righteousness and power in the fully gifted creation model. I mean, you say, how much less? It's about 10,000 times less. I mean, it's dramatic, the difference. And how much revelation you would get from nature in that model as you would with a model where God intervenes. Incidentally, this is what you're going to all be getting next week, okay? I've had a little insight as to what you're going to be sharing with us next week. And that's what we see in Genesis chapter 1, as we see in all these creation accounts. God does different things at different times. And what's wonderful is that you can read the text and get an idea, is this an intervention miracle, or is it not an intervention miracle? I want to remind you again, God does three different kinds of miracles, and they're all miracles. The Colossians 1 miracle, God holds everything together by his creative hand. If you were to let go his hand, everything would fall apart. So that's the fine-tuning argument. Everything is exquisitely fine-tuned to hold things together. That's what I would call God's sustaining miracles. He set up the physics, he set up the universe, created it with the right dimensions and characteristics that everything would be sustained for the support of life and advanced life in particular. But miracle number two would be what I would call intervention miracles, where God intervenes in some miraculous way without violating the laws of physics, but he uses those laws of physics and the matter and energy that it governs to design to create exactly the product that he wants. And finally, there are transcendent miracles, where God intervenes from beyond space, time, matter, and energy. A good example of that is creating the universe. He did that from beyond space, time, matter, and energy. And in terms of how the scientist looks at it, is that the vast majority of miracles we scientists observe are in category one. They're sustaining miracles, the fine-tuning arguments, the fine-tuning of machines inside the cell. Those are all examples of sustaining miracles. And they do reveal the glory of God in magnificent way. Less frequent, much less frequent, are the intervention miracles. But they're not zero. You know, I would argue with Howard Van Til that, you know, they're much less, but they're not zero. There are significant numbers of intervention miracles. Fewest of all would be the transcendent miracles. Yeah. Well, the reason why I'm reluctant to push the evidence on the Shroud of Turin is that there is great dispute over the authenticity of that evidence. You've got scientists saying we can definitively establish that it's not the Shroud of Jesus. You've got scientists trying to claim that it is. It's really different. In terms of the anthropic principle, there's a consensus amongst my peers that we are seeing here overwhelming evidence for design. Now, well, let me interrupt and just say this. God has blessed us with a lot of evidence that is not disputed by the reputable scholars in the field. Isn't that the logical place to start in trying to establish the evidence that Christ is a creator? And I do appreciate your first point. In terms of how we do our science apologetics, has not God set up the record of nature, not just to reveal the evidence for an ill-defined creative being, but for the person of Jesus Christ. We should expect our natural revelation model to actually have the potency to reveal Jesus Christ as the Creator. So in that sense, I'm right with you that we need to do that. But it would also seem to me that you want to start with your strongest, least disputed argument. Therefore, for example, in terms of the Shroud of Turin, I would say, you know, before you go down that path, why don't you start with the historical evidences for the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Those evidences do not get disputed from the reputable scholars, whether Christian or non-Christian. And then save to the end those arguments where you do have dispute. And we try to do that in our science, too. There's a lot of arguments that we could use where the scholars are divided. And saying, before we touch that, let's go with the stuff where there isn't that division. Well, yeah, but go with your best arguments first. Okay, that's all I'm saying. Go with the best arguments first. Yes, Kathy. Yeah, there's the rosin problem too. But the big dispute, if you're interested, is that there's one group of scientists, predominantly here at JPL, who are saying it's an extremely good, very clever 13th century forgery. And others are saying it really does date back to the first century. So that's where the dispute lies. And it's not just carbon 14. It has to do with dyes that have been discovered that were only discovered in the Shroud. They were only discovered in the 13th century, not first century. But there's also pollens there that take you right back to the part of Israel. And there's evidence suggestive of the first century. I'm not going to say any more than that, just that it's controversial at this point. But what is not controversial is the historical evidence that there was this man, Jesus, that rose bodily from the dead. There is no other historical explanation for the events that are recorded. Hey, I've only got 5 minutes left, so I was planning to spend about 45 minutes making you guys work. So 2 weeks from today, we'll do that. But you know what? I think we got a really good setup for what we're going to be doing next week. And I'm thrilled for that. And you guys should really have some fun here looking at these creation texts and discerning the chronology and what God was doing at the different times, getting some idea of the time scale. I hope I'm not advertising more than what you're going to deliver, but after all, what I'm trying to do is commit the class to help you through this. Okay. Okay, I'm not getting any younger, so... You can pray that God gives me I think it's 6 times I've got to speak from Friday night to Sunday morning. So would appreciate your prayers there. And pray for the rest of the team is going. We're taking our entire scholar team up too. So pray for them as well. We're going up to Fremont. By the way, you're all invited to come. We're doing one of our regional creation conferences in Fremont, California. A place called Bridges Community Church. It's a 6-hour drive from here, so short jaunt on Sunday morning. You can whiz up there. But it's Friday night, all day Saturday, and then Sunday morning. And you can come for any part of that you want. You say, where's Fremont? Yeah, it's just slightly east and a little bit north of San Jose. And it really is a 6-hour drive. As you zip up the 5 under all that heat. Okay. The question I left with you last week is, you know, we've been looking at Job 38, 39, 40, 41, and 42, and this is the passage that people dispute. Is it metaphorical? Is it literal? Well, there's obvious metaphors in there, but what's interesting is you get two prominent groups of Christian theologians that are saying that Job 38 and 39 are metaphorical, and Job 40 and 41 are not. Then you've got a group that's saying exactly the opposite. And this is one of the greatest areas of dispute in Christian theology in the church today. And so you're going through these texts and trying to pick out what is metaphorical and what is not. And if you didn't get this, we can get this distributed in a couple of minutes. If you didn't get a copy, we've got a thing called Evidences for Metaphor and Allegory in the Bible. So you didn't get that. A few of you don't have that. So if I could have you make a few of those copies available, that'll give you kind of a guideline. But one of the questions we left for you last week, why if Job 38 is about creation, does it not use a straight chronological sequence? And that indeed has been a major dispute amongst Christians. Some Christians take the point of view that if it's literal, it's going to be chronological. Well, I'm making the point that much of what we have here in Job 38 and 39 is literal, but it's not chronological. Well, that's a good question. If Job 38 is about creation, why does it not use a chronology? Why does it use this structure that it uses? Okay, and then an assignment I was hoping we could get to today is to break you up into groups, and we'll do this in a couple of weeks, but these are the questions I'm going to ask you to do. Last week we found lots of metaphors in Job 38, even though we're taking a position, as I've laid out here in the class, that much of Job 38 is meant to be taken literally. But there's these little metaphors scattered all the way through. Okay, what I want you to do is find a metaphor in Job 38 in your group, identify the metaphor, identify what kind of metaphor it is, and then these are the questions I got for you. How can you show that the metaphor is indeed a metaphor? How can you prove to a skeptic that the metaphor he's identified is indeed a metaphor? And then why would the text use the metaphor instead of simple literal text? And why does the text use a specific kind of metaphor that it does? As you'll see in the handout, there are many different forms of metaphor. Why does the text use a specific form? Which means you've got to identify the form and establish that it is that form and explain why it's using that form in that text, given that it's trying to make a particular literal point. So I'll write these questions out for you 2 weeks from today. I just got them scrawled out here. I'll type them up for you like we've typed these up. But it should be a fun exercise. I'm going to challenge each group to come up with a different example of the text. I think that'll be fun. Okay, maybe we can make some progress here in the class to resolving one of the major creation disputes in the church today. Maybe that's too grandiose. At least we can do it in the context of Sierra Madre Congregational Church. Maybe not. Maybe that's too grandiose. But we'll have fun regardless. Father in heaven, we thank you for these glorious texts of Scripture that you had recorded so many thousands of years ago. Though this may be indeed the most ancient book in the Bible, it is so relevant for what we're discovering on the frontiers of scientific research today. But Father, it's also a passage that's highly disputed and leads to a lot of hostility both in the church and outside the church. I pray, Father, you'd make us instruments of peace and resolution as we go through these texts. I'd also pray that we really have fun discovering things that we weren't aware of in this text. And Father, I want to thank you for the letters I've been getting from people in the class and their exciting discoveries of what they're finding here in the book of Job. And Father, I pray that we would all be blessed by the research that's going on from the members here in this class. I pray too, Father, you would give us specific opportunities, even in the next few days, where we could share some of our discoveries with people who don't yet know you as Lord and Savior and see them begin that journey to follow you as a result. Guide us by your Holy Spirit so we can share these truths with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience, that your Spirit indeed may be able to bring them into your kingdom. In Jesus' name, amen.